This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story.
It's a very fraught time to be a creative. I mean, it's a fraught time for all of us, but to be someone whose very existence revolves around trying to be honest about very difficult subjects, it's a very tricky time.
After the cancellation of Adelaide Writers Week in a furore over freedom of speech, conversations are being had around how much Australians value our writers and artists. Internationally renowned Australian painter Ben Quilty is asking that very question in a new essay exploring how we can be a more courageous country when it comes to the arts.
And I feel that although there's utter dismay in so many parts of my community, I think underlying that is a determination that I haven't felt before.
Today, Ben Quilty on what a culturally brave Australia might look like and how we get there. It's Monday, the 26th of January. Hi, Ben. Welcome to Full Story.
An absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I just want to start by looking at a quote in your essay. You wrote it as part of a book with a collection of authors writing about a braver future for Australia. And in it, you said, to be an artist in a society contemptuous of the very idea of art is an act of courage. Is that how you feel about yourself?
Regid, it is. I mean, I remember, and it's some years ago now, but I was probably in my early 40s when I first felt confident to say in the company of new people, introducing myself to people, to tell them when they say, what do you do with yourself, to admit or to acknowledge that I am an artist.
To admit you're an artist. Why?
Correct. I've spent time, lots of time in Europe and in the Middle East, North America and South America, all over the world, and nowhere have I felt that pressure. My expectation of what the response will be when I tell people that I'm an artist, and as a much younger man, there is no way I ever acknowledged that. It was too difficult. You would often be ridiculed. That's the first thing people would say, or say, how can you make money out of that? And there's no other career, really, mainstream career, and remembering that the arts is a billion, many billion dollar industry in Australia, where you would feel that pressure to admit that's something you do. And it goes right back to when I was at school and the first time that I was asked by a careers advisor in year 11, what did I want to do? And I'll never forget, he asked me what I wanted to do. And I was truthful. I said, I think I'd like to go to art school or possibly into the dramatic arts. And his response was to contact my parents and encourage them to re-enroll me in 3 in economics. I mean, it starts then. In fact, it started earlier than that. And I've thought much on this. I think around when we go to high school, we are expected to become cogs in the machine of the capitalist machine in Australia. We're meant to be working towards bringing some benefit to the economy. And I have brought benefit to the economy through my art practice and employ people and pay a lot of tax and very much a willing participant in it. But that is not the way it's seen as a child finishing primary school. There are very different expectations on kids, and it is not an accepted career path.
Well, we're all glad you didn't go into economics, but you're saying this is a uniquely Australian reaction.
From my experience, yes. I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time starting with the Brett Whiteley Travelling Arts Scholarship living in Paris, and when I told people what I was doing there, people would invite me over for dinner and have celebratory dinners welcoming their new friend who was an artist into their friend group. You don't get that in Australia. You might get that in Australia if you say you play first grade cricket for Northern Districts Cricket. You may get that sort of response in certain parts of our community, but no one in Australia is going to celebrate me being an artist and invite me to dinner because I tell them that's what I do.
And you talk about that as well in your essay, that you feel Australia very much values sport. Why don't you think Australia values art and culture?
Look, I think it goes back to our very beginnings and that epic wound that we have never properly healed, and that is the dispossession of First Nations Australians in this country. Most artists, and in my essay I talk about Henry Lawson and his remarks, and I'll quote to you from that essay: advice to any young Australian writer whose talents have been recognised would be to go to steerage, stow away, swim and seek London, Yankee Land or Timbuktu, rather than stay in Australia till his genius turned to gall or beer. Or failing this, and still in the interests of human nature and literature, to study elementary anatomy, especially as applied to the cranium, and then shoot himself carefully with the aid of a looking glass. I mean, that's all that time ago. There was this sense that the arts didn't matter. I think we're in a country that was peddling very fast to ignore the facts of what was happening around us, of the decimation of Indigenous populations, peddling very fast to grow an economy that would make lots of money. And in terms of sport is very much the most physical outpouring of our identity. A football game I always see is lasting for an hour and a half. We can beat an international team. We can beat a country with a much bigger GDP than ours. And in an hour and a half, give that audience not only the entertainment of an hour and a half of savage football, but also appease that sense that we're not as good as someone else, or that we have a history that needs to be made up for, and smash them literally into the soil of our own country. And it's that identity building. The quickest way to do it without acknowledging the pain of our past is to do it on the sporting field. And you won't find many artists who are willing to do something as vacuous as that in their own art practice. Now, saying that, I still play sport. I'm a huge sport. I'm a fanatic. I still play cricket. I played football until recently. I enjoy it, but it's not the way I talk to the world about my sense of my own identity.
Just playing devil's advocate here, we're talking about sort of Australia valuing the arts. We do see writers' festivals, Festival for Dangerous Ideas. We do see a lot of cultural and critical conversations about art. And some would argue, well, Australia does put a lot of value on that and put money into it.
Yeah, that's good, of course. And without great people in the arts making those things happen, it wouldn't be happening. I mean, I don't think Festival of Dangerous Ideas is at the top of the list of a go-to opening event for most politicians in Australia. There's often uncomfortable truths told that are very unfashionable in the political elite in those forums, and immensely important to have those discussions and debates. But, I mean, you and I appreciate you playing devil's advocate, but if you consider that the humanities degrees have doubled in their cost over the last 10 years, doubled. And art, I mean all arts in the broader sense, from sculpture and stand-up comedy to art history and ancient history, music, poetry, all of those things. Now, to study all of them, it's twice as expensive as it was. At the same time, and I'll give you the example from my own experience in the visual arts world, art schools are shutting down left, right and centre because of the financial pressure that universities are under. The first thing to go is the art school, because the square meterage costs money and artists need studio space, whereas a lecture theatre can accommodate English literature to business and economics all in one little theatre. Visual arts actually needs a space, as does performing arts and music. And all of those schools in all of our universities are, if they've survived the last 25 years, and many of them haven't, are under immense pressure. So our priorities are so skewed away from anything in the humanities and visual arts.
Well, on that, since we're talking about funding and you mentioned the decisions that you were told to make as a young student, do you think with the cost of living and degrees now, you would have been able to become an artist? We would be seeing Ben Quilty on the international stage.
Look, Richard, I was a pretty determined young person. I mean, I paid off my hex debt as a builder's labourer. I was a full-time builder's labourer for years after I finished my first degree. Nothing was going to stop me. And I think that the silver lining is that if you stop people who are driven to create, if you make it hard for them, in some senses, they'll probably make far more profound work. You won't stop us. You will make it harder for us.
Do you think we're losing the next generation because of that, of artists?
Oh, there's no doubt that we're making it difficult for them. Whether we're losing them or not, I as I said, I think that for a child who's determined to create, nothing will stop them. And you can see in some of the hotspots of horror in the world, the artists continue to create and make music and poetry and film because there's so much to talk about. I've been asked in the past when I would make something beautiful. When will I make some beautiful still lifes or pretty landscapes? And I've always said when there's nothing to make work about that's dark, and the world feels to me like our worst angels are set free. I feel like there's a lot of work to make at the moment, and not much of it is pretty or beautiful, because I'm driven to discuss the status quo and what's happening in the world, and most artists are the same.
We will come to some of what's happening in the world, but I want to turn to the notion of bravery in art and the freedom of expression. How intrinsically do you think those two are linked?
I think in Australia, and simply go back to the fact that I'm a straight, white, masculine male and was always very awkward to admit that I was an artist. If it's hard for me, then it's hard for most people, I think. And there is a portion of our community that really does despise the creative process and the arts. I used to wonder if it was to do with the messaging that comes out of us, that we're often talking about very sometimes delicate, often confronting, taboo, contentious issues. And that obviously there's a reason that some people will find it grotesque that we go there, but I think it's bigger than that. I think there's a sense that somehow our existence threatens their existence. And I think it's really tied into that, the capitalist model of eternal growth.
Have you ever experienced censorship?
No, but I've been put in positions where I've had to make conscious decisions knowing that what I am going to make is going to cause great consternation. I mean, I'll give you simple examples. Years ago, I made a show about Santa Claus, and my children were believers at the time, and I was showing my children these paintings. I thought I can't make fun or criticize this figure that's so important in their lives a few days every year. And they thought they were hilarious paintings. They loved it. They really enjoyed me engaging them to discuss those paintings. And I was then absolutely smashed by certain parts of the media for being the new face of the extreme left, and how dare I undermine, criticize and critique this figure.
If I'm remembering correctly, they were dark, dark paintings of Santa
Claus. They were very dark paintings, of course. But I absolutely believe that if I want to make critical comments of Santa Claus, I can say whatever the hell I want, and as dark as I want, as ridiculing as I want, or on the other hand, as celebratory as I want.
It leads me to the controversy we've been looking at the last couple of weeks, the Adelaide Writers' Week. I'm sure you've been looking at that as well. What are your thoughts when you saw that play out? What's your reaction?
Look, having been on several boards, the first thing I thought is this is just an epic failure of governance. And I have been on several boards, and I've often wondered at how we need more people from the arts on those boards who actually understand the nuance of what it means to be given a voice, to have freedom of expression in this country, to navigate those really taboo things. And quite often those boards, and therefore the governance, just fail to understand the creative process and how closely entwined that is with freedom of expression. And so for me, it was just one of those epic governance failures, and unforgivable, but people are put in those positions and they're out, clearly out of their depth. Who do we blame for that? We blame who appoints those people to those positions, I think.
Do you think what happened will have a chilling effect on artists, writers, people in your community?
I think it makes us more determined, to be honest with you, Reggie. I think we live in very uncertain, chaotic times, and I feel that although there's utter dismay in so many parts of my community, I think underlying that is a determination that I haven't felt before. I mean, the way those authors together stood up for freedom of expression and freedom of speech was very moving. And even though I heard certain people in the media criticise them, saying, who needs authors? Well, clearly we do. There's been an outpouring of support for them, and I'm an avid reader and have friends and am married to a great author. I thought it was an incredible time of power for those authors, even though we lost their voices. By being so united on that front, I think it was a very profound moment, and I think we'll find that the next Writers' Festival will be inundated. We want to hear those voices, and I think the people will stand up and through ticket sales show their support.
Well, more than 180 authors and speakers did drop out, as you say, after that decision to disinvite the author Randa Abdel-Fattah. You talk about the boards and a failure of governance. When you think about bravery and what a brave Australia looks like, is it the custodians of culture and art that are failing to be courageous as opposed to the artists themselves?
That's a good question. No, look, it's a very fraught time to be a creative. I mean, it's a fraught time for all of us, but to be someone whose very existence revolves around trying to be honest about very difficult subjects, it's a very tricky time. We're treading through a quagmire of extremely impassioned people and talking about issues that are going to cause offence no matter what your perspective is. So in what term, custodians, in what sense do you mean custodians?
Well, people who hold the purse strings, people who are the funders and the boards themselves, as you mentioned, is that where the problem is?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, I've been confronted several times over the last few years by people telling me they're going to dump all of my works at auction and threatening my financial viability.
Can you give us an example?
No, I think it's just toxic to even discuss it, to be honest with you. Well, the thing for those people, and I think most creatives are the same, well, I definitely can speak for myself. I didn't become an artist to make money. I would have studied 3 years of economics if that's what I wanted to do. And money, for me, as long as I can eat and pay my mortgage, that's what I'm here to do. So they weren't wielding a stick that I was scared of, that's for sure. But it did make me seriously consider how to tell the stories I want to tell with nuance. And I don't want to offend people. I'm not here to offend anyone. I've made paintings over the years going way back when politicians do disgraceful things. I often make a portrait the morning after they've made a disgrace of themselves, which are comic and offensive, and really they are for me a tonic for me to deal with the fact that human being is representing in some way the Australian people. But I won't show those paintings.
We'll be right back. Are there limits on freedom of speech, especially on the right? Because you said earlier, you know, you can paint Santa Claus however you want, however you see him, and you should be able to do that. Are there limits?
Yes, of course there should be limits. I don't think we should say things that incite violence. I don't think we should say things that are hateful. But, well, should we say things that are hateful? If someone is hateful and they voice their opinion, if we stop them voicing their opinion, that won't stop their hate. And I think we need to be very, very careful that if we start stopping people from giving terrible opinions on other people or the world, we're not actually fixing that issue and we're not healing that person or dissolving their hatred. In a sense, we're amplifying it in that human being. So I think it takes a very nuanced, very sophisticated, very intelligent discussions to decide what is hate and what should be banned. I think if it's inciting violence, it should be illegal, simple as that. You can't hurt other people. It's a criminal offence. And if you have the voice and now the amplification of your voice through social media, then you should be held accountable for that.
Obviously, with those hate speech laws going through Parliament, that is a big topic being discussed at the moment. Mm. I just want to break from your essay for the moment to come to global politics, which you mentioned earlier. I've been looking at your Last Supper collection, which you painted around when Donald Trump first became US president, first time around. And I'm looking at one of them that looked like Picasso's Guernica, which is all about the horrors of war. And it was feeling very prescient to me even back then. When you look at Donald Trump now, he's talking about taking Greenland by force. What are your reflections?
Oh, it feels like we're living in an alternate reality, doesn't it? The way he's treating Europe is just bizarre and terrifying. But I think if democracy can hold in that country, and I have outer faith that it will, then, for example, ICE agents, and having thought through what's happening with ICE agents, their behaviour is illegal. And the excuse that so-and-so told me to do it, right, I mean, it ends up with the president told me to do it. Now, the president will have presidential immunity, but no one else will have. And I think the next term, the next political term in America will see retribution like we've never seen before. And is that healthy? No, it's not. Of course it's not. And it won't solve the problem. Again, we're not solving the problem of this underlying hatred that exists in that community. to wheel right back round in this discussion, it just further imbues me with a sense that we need to tell our stories clearly. And in Australia, we need to continue to try and discern and decipher our own identity so that we don't follow down that path. And that goes through everything from contemporary media in terms of television and film and right through contemporary culture.
Is that what a culturally brave Australia would look like?
To be culturally brave in Australia, we don't know who we are yet. Compared to America, who's got 100 years on us, savagely wiped out the history of First Nations deaths, we have the opportunity to add these immense layers of social fibre into our community and in 100 years' time become far more infallible to what's happening in America now, I think. But it needs proper funding of the arts. It needs stories to be heard. It needs Australian content to be not just witnessed and used, but also examined and critiqued, or otherwise we're following straight down the path of America. And we seem so intent on it. The way language changes. I mean, the term gap year, my children use the term gap year. When I was at school, a gap year was this funny American term for having a year off after high school. Now all the children, all our children use that terminology. Language is changing to follow America. Our culture does not need to follow that country.
Ben Quilty, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was Australian artist Ben Quilty on his essay called Collective Ambition, which appears in the anthology A Time for Bravery, a series by some of Australia and the world's leading thinkers. It's published by the Australia Institute Press. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannon, who also did the sound design and mixing. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.